his life choices, and married Greg. He removed the cheap but serviceable replacement he had bought himself, and put Lucy's watch on instead. It was large and shiny with a metallic bracelet, and looked like a duplicate of Greg's. Nick and Ilse had bought him that whiskey you like. Aaron's single malt. It reminded him powerfully of Charlotte, with whom he had first tasted it, but any possibility of melancholy remembrance was chased away by the abrupt appearance in the doorway of three pyjamaed figures, the tallest of whom asked, "Is there cake yet?" Strike had never wanted children, an attitude Lucy deplored, and barely knew his nephews, whom he saw infrequently. The eldest and youngest trailed their mother out of the room to fetch his birthday cake. The middle boy, however, made a beeline for Strike and held out a homemade card. "That's you," said Jack, pointing at the picture, "getting your medal."
"Have you got a medal?"
asked Nina, smiling and wide-eyed.
"Thanks, Jack," said Strike.
"I want to be a soldier," said Jack.
"Your fault, Corn," said Greg, with what Strike could not help feeling was a certain animus.
"Buying him soldier toys, telling him about your gun."
"Two guns,"
Jack corrected his father.
"You had two guns,"
he told Strike,
"but you had to give them back."
"Good memory," Strike told him. "You'll go far."
Lucy appeared with a homemade cake, blazing with 36 candles, and decorated with what looked like hundreds of Smarties. As Greg turned out the light and everyone began to sing, Strike experienced an almost overwhelming desire to leave. He would ring a cab the instant he could escape the room. In the meantime, he hoisted a smile onto his face and blew out his candles, avoiding the gaze of Marguerite, who was smouldering at him with an unnerving lack of restraint from a nearby chair. It was not his fault that he had been made to play the decorated helpmeet of abandoned women by his well-meaning friends and family. Strike called a cab from the downstairs bathroom and announced half an hour later, with a decent show of regret, that he and Nina would have to leave. He had to be up early the next day. Out in the crowded and noisy hall, after Strike had neatly dodged being kissed on the mouth by Marguerite, while his nephews worked off their excitement and a late-night sugar rush, and Greg helped Nina officiously into her coat, Nick muttered to Strike,
"I didn't think you fancied little women."
"I don't," Strike returned quietly. "She nicked something for me yesterday."
"Yeah, well, I'd show your gratitude by letting her go on top," said Nick. "You could squash her like a beetle."
Chapter 16. "Let not our supper be raw, for you shall have blood enough, your belly full." Thomas Dekker and Thomas Middleton, The Honest Whore. Strike knew immediately upon waking the following morning that he was not in his own bed. It was too comfortable, the sheets too smooth. The daylight stippling the covers fell from the wrong side of the room, and the sound of the rain pattering against the window was muffled by drawn curtains. He pushed himself up into a sitting position, squinting around at Nina's bedroom, glimpsed only briefly by lamplight the previous evening, and caught sight of his own naked torso in a mirror opposite, thick, dark chest hair making a black blot against the pale blue wall behind him. Nina was absent, but he could smell coffee. As he had anticipated, she had been enthusiastic and energetic in bed, driving away the slightest melancholy that had threatened to follow him from his birthday celebrations. Now, though, he wondered how quickly he would be able to extricate himself. To linger would be to raise expectations he was not prepared to meet. His prosthetic leg was propped against the wall beside the bed. On the point of sliding himself out of bed to reach it, he drew back, because the bedroom door opened, and in walked Nina, fully dressed and damp-haired, with newspapers under her arm, two mugs of coffee in one hand, and a plate of croissants in the other.
"I nipped out," she said breathlessly. "God, it's horrible out there. Feel my nose, I'm frozen."
"You didn't have to do that," he said, gesturing to the croissants.
"I'm starving, and there's a fabulous bakery up the road. Look at this,
News of the World. Dom's big exclusive.
A photograph of the disgraced peer, whose hidden account Strike had revealed to Culpepper, filled the middle of the front page, flanked on three sides by pictures of his two lovers and of the Cayman Island documents Strike had wrested from his PA. "Lord Porker of Paywell," screamed the headline. Strike took the paper from Nina and skim-read the story. Culpepper had kept his word. The heartbroken PA was not mentioned anywhere. Nina was sitting beside Strike on the bed, reading along with him, emitting faintly amused comments.
"Oh, God, how anyone could look at him! And, oh, wow, that's disgusting."
"Won't do Culpepper any harm," Strike said, closing the paper when both had finished.
The date at the top of the front page caught his eye. 21st of November. It was his ex-fiancée's birthday. A small painful tug under the solar plexus and a sudden gush of vivid, unwelcome memories. A year ago, almost to the hour, he had woken up beside Charlotte in Holland Park Avenue. He remembered her long black hair, wide hazel-green eyes, a body the like of which he would never see again, never be permitted to touch. They had been happy that morning. The bed a life raft bobbing on the turbulent sea of their endlessly recurring troubles. He had presented her with a bracelet, the purchase of which had necessitated, though she did not know it, the taking out of a loan at horrifying rates of interest. And 2 days later, on his own birthday, she had given him an Italian suit, and they had gone out to dinner and actually fixed on a date when they would marry at last, 16 years after they had first met. But the naming of a day had marked a new and dreadful phase in their relationship, as though it had damaged the precarious tension in which they were used to living. Charlotte had become steadily more volatile, more capricious. Rows and scenes, broken china, accusations of his unfaithfulness, when it had been she, he now believed, who had been secretly meeting the man to whom she was now engaged. They had struggled on for nearly 4 months until, in a final, filthy explosion of recrimination and rage, everything had ended for good. A rustle of cotton. Strike looked around, almost surprised to find himself still in Nina's bedroom. She was about to strip off her top, intending to get back into bed with him.
"I can't stay," he told her, stretching across for his prosthesis again.
"Why not?"
she asked with her arms folded across her front, gripping the hem of her skirt.
"Come on, it's Sunday."
"I've got to work," he lied. "People need investigating on Sundays, too."
"Oh," she said,
trying to sound matter-of-fact, but looking crestfallen. He drank his coffee, keeping the conversation bright but impersonal. She watched him strap his leg on and head for the bathroom, and when he returned to dress, she was curled up in a chair, munching a croissant with a slightly forlorn air.
"Are you sure you don't know where this house was? The one Quine and Fancourt inherited?" he asked her as he pulled on his trousers.
"What?" she said, confused. "Oh, God, you're not going looking for that, are you? I told you it'll have been sold years ago."
"I might ask Quine's wife about it," said Strike.
He told her that he would call her, but briskly, so that she might understand these to be empty words, a matter of form, and left her house with a feeling of faint gratitude, but no guilt. The rain jabbed again at his face and hands as he walked down the unfamiliar street, heading for the tube station. Christmassy fairy lights twinkled from the window of the bakery where Nina had just bought croissants. Strike's large, hunched reflection slid across the rain-spotted surface, clutching in one cold fist the plastic carrier bag which Lucy had helpfully given him to carry his cards, his birthday whiskey, and the box of his shiny new watch. His thoughts slid irresistibly back to Charlotte, 36 but looking 25, celebrating her birthday with her new fiancé. Perhaps she had received diamonds, Strike thought. She had always said she didn't care for such things, but when they had argued, the glitter of all he could not give her had sometimes been flung back hard in his face.
"Successful bloke?" Greg had asked of Owen Quine, by which he meant big car, nice house, fat bank balance.
Strike passed the Beatles coffee shop, with its jauntily positioned black and white heads of the Fab Four peering out at him, and entered the relative warmth of the station. He did not want to spend this rainy Sunday alone in his attic rooms in Denmark Street. He wanted to keep busy on the anniversary of Charlotte Campbell's birth. Pausing to take out his mobile, he telephoned Leonora Quine.
"Hello,"
she said brusquely.
"Hi, Leonora. It's Cormor and Strike here.
Have you found Owen?" she demanded.
"Afraid not. I'm calling because I've just heard that your husband was left a house by a friend."
"What house?" She sounded tired and irritable. He thought of the various moneyed husbands he had come up against professionally, men who hid bachelor apartments from their wives, and wondered whether he had just given away something that Quine had been keeping from his family.
"Isn't it true? Didn't a writer called Joe North leave a house jointly to—"
"Oh, that," she said. "Talgoth Road, yeah. That was 30-odd years ago, though. What do you want to know about that for?"
"It's been sold, has it?"
"No," she said resentfully. "Because bloody Fancourt never let us. Out of spite it is because he never uses it. It just sits there, no use to anyone, mouldering away."
Strike leaned back against the wall beside the ticket machines, his eyes fixed on a circular ceiling, supported by a spider's web of struts. This, he told himself again, is what comes of taking on clients when you're wrecked. He should have asked if they owned any other properties. He should have checked.
"Has anyone gone to see whether your husband's there, Mrs. Quine?"
She emitted a hoot of derision.
"He wouldn't go there,"
she said, as though Strike was suggesting that her husband had hidden in Buckingham Palace.
"He hates it. He never goes near it. Anyway, I don't think it's got furniture or nothing. Have you got a key?"
"I dunno, but Owen would never go there. He hasn't been near it in years. It'd be an horrible place to stay, old and empty."
"If you could have a look for the key."
"I can't go tearing off to Talgoth Road, I've got Orlando," she said predictably. "Anyway, I'm telling you, he wouldn't—"
"I'm offering to come over now," said Strike. "Get the key from you, if you can find it, and go and check. Just to make sure we've looked everywhere."
"Yeah, but it's Sunday," she said, sounding taken aback.
"I know it is. Do you think you could have a look for the key?"
"All right, then," she said after a short pause. "But—" with a last burst of spirit,
"he won't be there!"
Strike took the tube, changing once to Westbourne Park, and then, collar turned up against the icy deluge, marched towards the address that Leonora had scribbled down for him at their first meeting. It was another of those odd pockets of London where millionaires sat within a stone's throw of working-class families who had occupied their homes for 40 years or more. The rainwash scene presented an odd diorama. Sleek new apartment blocks behind quiet, nondescript terraces, the luxurious new, and the comfortable old. The Quine's family home was in Southern Row, a quiet back street of small brick houses, a short walk from a whitewashed pub called the Chilled Eskimo. Cold and wet, Strike squinted up at the sign overhead as he passed. It depicted a happy Inuit relaxing beside a fishing hole, his back to the rising sun. The door of the Quine's house was a peeling sludge green. Everything about the frontage was dilapidated, including the gate hanging on by only one hinge. Strike thought of Quine's predilection for comfortable hotel rooms as he rang the doorbell, and his opinion of the missing man fell a little further.
"You were quick," was Leonora's gruff greeting on opening the door.
"Come in."
He followed her down a dim, narrow hallway. To the left, a door stood ajar onto what was clearly Owen Quine's study. It looked untidy and dirty. Drawers hung open, and an old electric typewriter sat skewed on the desk.
Strike could picture Quine tearing pages from it in his rage at Elizabeth Tassel.
"Any luck with the key?"
Strike asked Leonora, as they entered the dark, stale-smelling kitchen at the end of the hall. The appliances all looked as though they were at least 30 years old. Strike had an idea that his Aunt Joan had owned the identical dark brown microwave back in the '80s.
"Well, I found them,"
Leonora told him, gesturing towards half a dozen keys lying on the kitchen table.
"I dunno whether any of them's the right one."
None of them was attached to a keyring, and one of them looked too big to open anything but a church door.
"What number Talgarth Road?"
Strike asked her.
179. "When were you last there?"
"Me? I've never been there," she said with what seemed genuine indifference. "I wasn't interested. Silly thing to do."
"What was?"
"Leaving it to them." In the face of Strike's politely inquiring face, she said impatiently,
"That Joe North leaving it to Owen and Michael Fancourt. He said it was for them to write in. They've never used it since. Useless."
"And you've never been there?"
"No. They got it round the time I had Orlando. I wasn't interested," she repeated.
"Orlando was born then?"
Strike asked, surprised. He had been vaguely imagining Orlando as a hyperactive 10-year-old.
"In 86, yeah," said Leonora. "But she's handicapped."
"Oh," said Strike. "I see."
"Upstairs sulking now because I had to tell her off,"
said Leonora, in one of her bursts of expansiveness.
"She nicks things. She knows it's wrong, but she keeps doing it. I caught her taking Edna next door's purse out of her bag when she come round yesterday. It wasn't 'cause of the money," she said quickly,
as though he had made an accusation.
"It's 'cause she liked the colour. Edna understands 'cause she knows her, but not everyone does. I tell her it's wrong. She knows it's wrong."
"All right if I take these and try them then?"
Strike asked, scooping the keys into his hand.
"If you want," said Leonora, but she added defiantly, "He won't be there."
Strike pocketed his haul, turned down Leonora's afterthought offer of tea or coffee, and returned to the cold rain. He found himself limping again as he walked towards Westbourne Park tube station, which would mean a short journey with minimal changes. He had not taken as much care as usual in attaching his prosthesis in his haste to get out of Nina's flat, nor had he been able to apply any of those soothing products that help protect the skin beneath it. 8 months previously, on the very day that he had later been stabbed in his upper arm, he had taken a bad fall down some stairs. The consultant who had examined it shortly afterwards had informed him that he had done additional, though probably reparable, damage to the medial ligaments in the knee joint of his amputated leg, and advised ice, rest, and further investigation. But Strike had not been able to afford rest, and had not wished for further tests, so he had strapped up the knee and tried to remember to elevate his leg when sitting. The pain had mostly subsided, but occasionally, when he had done a lot of walking, it began to throb and swell again. The road along which Strike was trudging curved to the right. A tall, thin, hunched figure was walking behind him, its head bowed so that only the top of a black hood was visible. Of course, the sensible thing to do would be to go home now and rest his knee. It was Sunday. There was no need for him to go marching all over London in the rain.
"He won't be there," said Leonora in his head.
But the alternative was returning to Denmark Street, listening to the rain hammering against the badly fitting window beside his bed under the eaves, with photo albums full of Charlotte too close, in the boxes on the landing. Better to move, to work, to think about other people's problems. Blinking in the rain, he glanced up at the houses he was passing, and glimpsed in his peripheral vision the figure following 20 yards behind him. Though the dark coat was shapeless, Strike had the impression from the short, quick steps that the figure was female. Now Strike noticed something curious about the way she was walking, something unnatural.
There was none of the self-preoccupation of the lone stroller on a cold, wet day. Her head was not bowed in protection against the elements, nor was she maintaining a steady pace with the simple view of achieving a destination. She kept adjusting her speed in tiny, but to Strike, noticeable increments, and every few steps, the hidden face beneath the hood presented itself to the chilly onslaught of the driving rain, then vanished again into shadow. She was keeping him in her sights. What had Leonora said at their first meeting?
"I think I've been followed. Tall, dark girl with round shoulders."
Strike experimented by speeding up and slowing down, infinitesimally. The space between them remained constant. Her hidden face flickered up and down more frequently, a pale pink blur, to check his position. She was not experienced at following people. Strike, who was an expert, would have taken the opposite pavement, pretended to be talking on a mobile phone, concealed his focused and singular interest in the subject. For his own amusement, he faked a sudden hesitation, as though he had been caught by a doubt as to the right direction. Caught off guard, the dark figure stopped dead, paralyzed. Strike strolled on again, and after a few seconds heard her footsteps echoing on the wet pavement behind him. She was too foolish even to realize that she had been rumbled. Westbourne Park Station came into sight a little way ahead, a long, low building of golden brick. He would confront her there, ask her the time, get a good look at her face. Turning into the station, he drew quickly to the far side of the entrance, waiting for her, out of sight. Some 30 seconds later, he glimpsed the tall, dark figure jogging towards the entrance through the glittering rain, hands still in her pockets. She was frightened that she might have missed him, that he was already on a train. He took a swift, confident step out into the doorway to face her. The false foot slipped on the wet tiled floor and skidded. Fuck! With an undignified descent into half splits, he lost his footing and fell. In the long slow-motion seconds before he reached the dirty wet floor, landing painfully on the bottle of whiskey in his carrier bag, he saw her freeze in silhouette in the entrance, then vanish like a startled deer.
"Bollocks!" he gasped,
lying on the sopping tiles while people at the ticket machine stared. He had twisted his leg again as he fell. It felt as though he might have torn a ligament. The knee that had been merely sore was now screaming in protest. Inwardly cursing imperfectly mopped floors and prosthetic ankles of rigid construction, Strike tried to get up. Nobody wanted to approach him. No doubt they thought he was drunk. Nick and Ilse's whiskey had now escaped the carrier bag and was rolling clunkily across the floor. Finally, a London Underground employee helped him to his feet, muttering about there being a warning sign of the wet floor. Hadn't the gentleman seen it? Wasn't it prominent enough? He handed Strike his whiskey. Humiliated, Strike muttered a thank you and limped over to the ticket barriers, wanting only to escape the countless staring eyes. Safely on a southbound train, he stretched out his throbbing leg and probed his knee as best he could through his suit trousers. It felt tender and sore, exactly as it had after he had fallen down those stairs last spring. Furious now, with the girl who had been following him, he tried to make sense of what had happened. When had she joined him? Had she been watching the Quine Place, seen him go inside? Might she, an unflattering possibility, have mistaken Strike for Owen Quine? Catherine Kent had certainly done so, briefly, in the dark. Strike got to his feet some minutes before changing at Hammersmith to better prepare himself for what might be a perilous descent. By the time he reached his destination of Baron's Court, he was limping heavily and wishing that he had a stick. He made his way out of a ticket hall tiled in Victorian pea green, placing his feet with care on the floor covered in grimy wet prints. Too soon, he had left the dry shelter of the small jewel of a station, with its Art Nouveau lettering and stone pediments, and proceeded in the relentless rain towards the rumbling dual carriageway that lay close by.
To his relief and gratitude, he realized that he had emerged on that very stretch of Talgarth Road where the house he sought stood. Though London was full of these kinds of architectural anomalies, he had never seen buildings that jarred so obviously with their surroundings. The old houses sat in a distinctive row, dark red brick relics of a more confident and imaginative time, while traffic rumbled unforgivingly past them in both directions, for this was the main artery into London from the west. They were ornate, late Victorian artists' studios, their lower windows leaded and latticed, and oversized arched north-facing windows on their upper floors, like fragments of the vanished Crystal Palace. Wet, cold and sore though he was, Strike paused for a few seconds to look up at number 179, marvelling at its distinctive architecture, and wondering how much the Quines would stand to make if Fancourt ever changed his mind and agreed to sell. He heaved himself up the white front steps. The front door was sheltered from the rain by a brick canopy richly ornamented with carved stone swags, scrolls and badges. Strike brought out the keys one by one with cold, numb fingers. The fourth one he tried slid home without protest and turned as though it had been doing so for years. One gentle click, and the front door slid open. He crossed the threshold and closed the door behind him. A shock, like a slap in the face, like a falling bucket of water. Strike fumbled with his coat collar, dragging it up over his mouth and nose to protect them. Where he should have smelled only dust and old wood, something sharp and chemical was overwhelming him, catching in his nose and throat. He reached automatically for a switch on the wall beside him, producing a flood of light from two bare light bulbs hanging from the ceiling. The hallway, which was narrow and empty, was panelled in honey-coloured wood. Twisted columns of the same material supported an arch halfway along its length. At first glance it was serene, gracious, well-proportioned. But with eyes narrowed, Strike slowly took in the wide, burn-like stains on the original woodwork. A corrosive, acrid fluid, which was making the still, dusty air burn, had been splashed everywhere in what seemed to have been an act of wanton vandalism. It had stripped varnish from the aged floorboards, blasted the patina off the bare wood stairs ahead, even been thrown over the walls so that large patches of painted plaster were bleached and discoloured. After a few seconds of breathing through his thick serge collar, it occurred to Strike that the place was too warm for an uninhabited house. The heating had been cranked up high, which made the fierce chemical smell waft more pungently than if it had been left to disperse in the chill of a winter's day. Paper rustled under his feet. Looking down, he saw a smattering of takeaway menus and an envelope addressed to the occupier, caretaker. He stooped and picked it up. It was a brief, angry handwritten note from the next-door neighbour, complaining about the smell. Strike let the note fall back onto the doormat and moved forwards into the hall, observing the scars left on every surface where the chemical substance had been thrown. To his left was a door. He opened it. The room beyond was dark and empty. It had not been tarnished with the bleach-like substance. A dilapidated kitchen, also devoid of furnishings, was the only other room on the lower floor. The deluge of chemicals had not spared it. Even a stale half-loaf of bread on the sideboard had been doused. Strike headed up the stairs. Somebody had climbed or descended them, pouring the vicious, corrosive substance from a capacious container. It had splattered everywhere, even onto the landing windowsill, where the paint had bubbled and split apart. On the first floor, Strike came to a halt. Even through the thick wool of his overcoat, he could smell something else. Something that the pungent industrial chemical could not mask. Sweet, putrid, rancid. The stench of decaying flesh. He did not try either of the closed doors on the first floor. Instead, With his birthday whiskey swaying stupidly in its plastic bag, he followed slowly in the footsteps of the pourer of acid, up a second flight of stained stairs from which the varnish had been burned away, the carved banisters scorched bare of their waxy shine. The stench of decay grew stronger with every step Strike took. It reminded him of the time they stuck long sticks into the ground in Bosnia and pulled them out to sniff the ends, the one fail-safe way of finding the mass graves. He pressed his collar more tightly to his mouth as he reached the top floor, to the studio where a Victorian artist had once worked in the unchanging northern light. Strike did not hesitate on the threshold, except for the seconds it took to tug his shirt sleeve down to cover his bare hand, so that he would make no mark on the wooden door as he pushed it open. Silence, but for a faint squeak of hinges. And then the desultory buzzing of flies. He had expected death, but not this. A carcass, trussed, stinking and rotting, empty and gutted, lying on the floor instead of hanging from a metal hook where it surely belonged. But what looked like a slaughtered pig wore human clothing. It lay beneath the high arched beams, bathed in light from that gigantic Romanesque window, and though it was a private house, and the traffic sloshed still beyond the glass, Strike felt that he stood retching in a temple, witness to sacrificial slaughter, to an act of unholy desecration. 7 plates and 7 sets of cutlery had been set around the decomposing body, as though it were a gigantic joint of meat. The torso had been slit from throat to pelvis, and Strike was tall enough to see, even from the threshold, the gaping black cavity that had been left behind. The intestines were gone, as though they had been eaten. Fabric and flesh had been burned away all over the corpse, heightening the vile impression that it had been cooked and feasted upon. In places, the burned, decomposing cadaver was shining, almost liquid in appearance. 4 hissing radiators were hastening the decay. The rotted face lay furthest away from him, near the window. Strike squinted at it without moving, trying not to breathe. A wisp of yellowing beard clung still to the chin, and a single burned-out eye socket was just visible. And now, with all his experience of death and mutilation, Strike had to fight down the urge to vomit in the almost suffocating mingled stenches of chemical and corpse. He shifted his carrier bag up his thick forearm, drew his mobile phone out of his pocket, and took photographs of the scene from as many angles as he could manage without moving further into the room. Then he backed out of the studio, allowing the door to swing shut, which did nothing to mitigate the almost solid stink, and called 999. Slowly and carefully, determined not to slip and fall, even though he was desperate to regain fresh, clean, rain-washed air, Strike proceeded back down the tarnished stairs to wait for the police in the street. Chapter 17. Best while you have it, use your breath. There is no drinking after death. John Fletcher, the Bloody Brother. It was not the first time that Strike had visited New Scotland Yard at the insistence of the Met. His previous interview had also concerned a corpse, and it occurred to the detective, as he sat waiting in an interrogation room many hours later, the pain in his knee less acute after several hours of enforced action, that he had had sex the previous evening then, too. Alone in a room, hardly bigger than the average office's stationery cupboard, his thoughts stuck like flies to the rotting obscenity he had found in the artist's studio. The horror of it had not left him. In his professional capacity, he had viewed bodies that had been dragged into positions intended to suggest suicide or accident, had examined corpses bearing horrific traces of attempts to disguise the cruelty to which they had been subjected before death. He had seen men, women, and children maimed and dismembered. But what he had seen at 179 Talgarth Road was something entirely new. The malignity of what had been done there had been almost orgiastic, a carefully calibrated display of sadistic showmanship. Worse to contemplate was the order in which acid had been poured, the body disemboweled. Had it been torture? Had Quine been alive or dead while his killer laid out place settings around him? The huge vaulted room where Quine's body lay would now, no doubt, be swarming with men in full-body protective suits, gathering forensic evidence. Strike wished he were there with them. Inactivity after such a discovery was hateful to him. He burned with professional frustration. Shut out from the moment the police had arrived, he had been relegated to a mere blunderer who had stumbled onto the scene. And scene, he thought suddenly, was the right word in more ways than one. The body tied up and arranged in the light from that giant church-like window. A sacrifice to some demonic power. 7 plates. 7 sets of cutlery. The frosted glass window of the interrogation room blocked out everything beyond it but the colour of the sky, now black. He had been in this tiny room for a long time, and still the police had not finished taking his statement. It was difficult to gauge how much of their desire to prolong the interview was genuine suspicion, how much animosity. It was right, of course, that the person who discovered a murder victim should be subjected to thorough questioning, because they often knew more than they were willing to tell, and not infrequently, knew everything. However, in solving the Lula Landry case, Strike might be said to have humiliated the Met, who had so confidently pronounced her death suicide. Strike did not think he was being paranoid in thinking that the attitude of the crop-haired female detective inspector, who had just left the room, contained a determination to make him sweat. Nor did he think that it had been strictly necessary for quite so many of her colleagues to look in on him, some of them lingering only to stare at him, others delivering snide remarks. If they thought they were inconveniencing him, they were wrong. He had nowhere else to be, and they had fed him quite a decent meal. If they had only let him smoke, he would have been quite comfortable. The woman who had been questioning him for an hour had told him he might go outside, accompanied, into the rain for a cigarette, but inertia and curiosity had kept him in his seat. His birthday whiskey sat beside him in its carrier bag. He thought that if they kept him here much longer, he might break it open. They had left him a plastic beaker of water. The door behind him whispered over the dense grey carpet.
"Mystic Bob," said a voice.
Richard Anstis, of the Metropolitan Police and the Territorial Army, entered the room grinning, his hair wet with rain, carrying a bundle of papers under his arm. One side of his face was heavily scarred, the skin beneath his right eye pulled taut. They had saved his sight at the field hospital in Kabul, while Strike had lain unconscious, doctors working to preserve the knee of his severed leg.
"Anstis," said Strike, taking the policeman's proffered hand.
"What the—" "Pull rank, mate. I'm going to handle this one," said Anstis, dropping into the seat lately vacated by the surly female detective.
"You're not popular around here, you know. Lucky for you, you've got Uncle Dickie on your side, vouching for you."
He always said that Strike had saved his life, and perhaps it was true. They had been under fire on a yellow dirt road in Afghanistan. Strike himself was not sure what had made him sense the imminent explosion. The youth running from the roadside ahead, with what looked like his younger brother, could simply have been fleeing the gunfire. All he knew was that he had yelled at the driver of the Viking to brake, an injunction not followed, perhaps not heard, that he had reached forward, grabbed Anstis by the back of the shirt, and hauled him one-handed into the back of the vehicle. Had Anstis remained where he was, he would probably have suffered the fate of young Gary Topley, who had been sitting directly in front of Strike, and of whom they could only find the head and torso to bury.
"Need to run through this story one more time, mate," said Anstice, spreading out in front of him the statement that he must have taken from the female officer.
"All right if I drink?" asked Strike wearily.
Under Anstice's amused gaze, Strike retrieved the Aran single malt from the carrier bag and added two fingers to the lukewarm water in his plastic cup.
"Right. You were hired by his wife to find the dead man. We're assuming the body's this writer's, this... Owen Quine, yeah," supplied Strike, as Anstice squinted over his colleague's handwriting.
"His wife hired me 6 days ago.
And at that point he'd been missing...
10 days.
But she hadn't been to the police?"
"No, he did this regularly. Dropped out of sight without telling anyone where he was, then coming home again. He liked taking off for hotels without his wife."
"Why did she bring you in this time?"
"Things are difficult at home. There is a disabled daughter and money's short. He'd been away a bit longer than usual. She thought he'd gone off to a writer's retreat. She didn't know the name of the place, but I checked and he wasn't there.
Still don't see why she called you rather than us.
She says she called your lot in once before when he went walkabout and he was angry about it. Apparently he'd been with a girlfriend."
"I'll check that," said Anstice, making a note.
"What made you go to that house?"
"I found out last night the Quines co-owned it."
A slight pause. "His wife hadn't mentioned it?"
"No," said Strike. "Her story is he hated the place and never went near it. She gave the impression she'd half forgotten they even owned it."
"Was that likely?" murmured Anstice, scratching his chin. "If they're skint."
"It's complicated," said Strike. "The other owner's Michael Fancourt."
"I've heard of him."
"And she says he won't let them sell. There was bad blood between Fancourt and Quine."
Strike drank his whiskey. It warmed throat and stomach. Quine's stomach, his entire digestive tract, had been cut out. Where the hell was it?
"Anyway, I went along at lunchtime and there he was. Or most of him was."
The whiskey had made him crave a cigarette worse than ever.
"The body's a real fucking mess from what I've heard," said Anstice.
"Wanna see?"
Strike pulled his mobile phone from his pocket, brought up the photograph of the corpse, and handed it across the desk.
"Holy shit," said Anstice.
After a minute of silent contemplation of the rotting corpse, he asked, disgusted,
"What are those around him? Plates?"
"Yep," said Strike.
"That mean anything to you?"
"Nothing," said Strike.
"Any idea when he was last seen alive?"
"The last time his wife saw him was the night of the 5th. He'd just had dinner with his agent, who told him he couldn't publish his latest book because he's libeled Christ knows how many people, including a couple of very litigious men."
Anstice looked down at the notes left by D.I. Rawlins.
"You didn't tell Bridget that?"
"She didn't ask. We didn't strike up much of a rapport."
"How long's this book been in the shops?"
"It isn't in the shops," said Strike, adding more whiskey to his beaker. "It hasn't been published yet. I told you he rowed with his agent because she told him he couldn't publish it."
"Have you read it?"
"Most of it."
"Did his wife give you a copy?"
"No, she says she's never read it."
"She forgot she owned a second house and she doesn't read her own husband's books," said Anstice, without emphasis.
"Her story is that she reads them once they got proper covers on," said Strike. "For what it's worth, I believe her."
"Uh-huh," said Anstice, who was now scribbling additions to Strike's statement. "How did you get a copy of the manuscript?"
"I'd prefer not to say."
"Could be a problem," said Anstice, glancing up.
"Not for me," said Strike.
"We might need to come back to that one, Bob."
Strike shrugged, then asked,
"Has his wife been told?"
"Should have been by now, yeah."
Strike had not called Leonora. The news that her husband was dead must be broken in person by somebody with the necessary training. He had done the job himself many times, but he was out of practice. In any case, his allegiance this afternoon had been to the desecrated remains of Owen Quine, to stand watch over them until he had delivered them safely into the hands of the police. He had not forgotten what Leonora would be going through while he was interrogated at Scotland Yard. He had imagined her opening the door to the police officer, or two of them perhaps, the first thrill of alarm at the sight of the uniform, the hammer blow dealt to the heart by the calm, understanding, sympathetic invitation to retire indoors. The horror of the pronouncement. Although they would not tell her, at least at first, about the thick purple ropes binding her husband, or the dark, empty cavern that a murderer had made of his chest and belly. They would not say that his face had been burned away by acid, or that somebody had laid out plates around him as though he were a giant roast. Strike remembered the platter of lamb that Lucy had handed around nearly 24 hours previously. He was not a squeamish man, but the smooth malt seemed to catch in his throat, and he set down his beaker.
"How many people know what's in this book, do you reckon?" asked Anstis slowly.
"No idea," said Strike. "Could be a lot by now. Quine's agent, Elizabeth Tassel, spelled like it sounds," he added helpfully, as Anstis scribbled. "Sent it to Christian Fisher at Crossfire Publishing, and he's a man who likes to gossip. Lawyers got involved to try and stop the talk."
"More and more interesting," muttered Anstis, writing fast. "You want anything else to eat, Bob?"
"I want a smoke."
"Won't be long," promised Anstis.
"Who's he libeled?"
"The question is," said Strike, flexing his sore leg, "whether it's libel or whether he's exposed the truth about people. But the characters I recognize were, give us a pen and paper," he said, because it was quicker to write than to dictate. He said the names aloud as he jotted them down. "Michael Fancourt, the writer. Daniel Chard, who's head of Quine's publisher. Catherine Kent, Quine's girlfriend."
"There's a girlfriend?"
"Yeah, they've been together over a year, apparently. I went to see her. Stafford Cripp's house, part of Clement Attlee Court. And she claimed he wasn't at her flat and she hadn't seen him. Liz Tassel, his agent. Jerry Waldegrave, his editor, and..." A fractional hesitation. "His wife." "He's put his wife in there as well, has he?"
"Yeah,"
said Strike, pushing the list over the desk to Anstis. "But there are a load of other characters I wouldn't recognize. You've got a wide field if you're looking for someone he put in the book."
"Have you still got the manuscript?"
"No."
Strike, expecting the question, lied easily. Let Anstis get a copy of his own, without Nina's fingerprints on it.
"Anything else you can think of that might be helpful?" Anstis asked, sitting up straight.
"Yeah," said Strike. "I don't think his wife did it."
Anstis shot Strike a quizzical look, not unmixed with warmth. Strike was godfather to the son who had been born to Anstis just 2 days before both of them had been blown out of the Viking. Strike had met Timothy Cormoran and Anstis a handful of times, and had not been impressed in his favour.
"Okay, Bob, sign this for us and I can give you a lift home."
Strike read through the statement carefully, took pleasure in correcting D.I. Rawlins's spelling in a few places, and signed. His mobile rang as he and Anstis walked down the long corridor towards the lifts, Strike's knee protesting painfully.
"Cormoran Strike."
"It's me, Leonora," she said,
sounding almost exactly as she usually did, except that her voice was perhaps a little less flat. Strike gestured to Anstis that he was not ready to enter the lift, and drew aside from the policeman to a dark window beneath which traffic was winding in the endless rain.
"Have the police been to see you?" he asked her.
"Yeah, I'm with them now."
"I'm very sorry, Leonora," he said.
"You all right?" she asked gruffly.
Me? Said Strike, surprised. I'm fine.
They ain't giving you hard time. They said you were being interviewed. I said to him. He only found Owen because I asked him. What's he been arrested for?
They hadn't arrested me, said Strike. Just needed a statement.
But they've kept you all this time.
How do you know how long?
I'm here, she said. I'm downstairs in the lobby. I want to see you. I made him bring me.
Astonished, with the whiskey sitting on his empty stomach, he said the first thing that occurred to him.
Who's looking after Orlando?
Edna,
said Leonora, taking Strike's concern for her daughter as a matter of course.
When are they going to let you go?
I'm on my way out now, he said.
Who's that? Asked Anstice, when Strike had rung off. Charlotte worrying about you?
Christ, no, said Strike as they stepped together into the lift.
He had completely forgotten that he had never told Anstice about the breakup. As a friend from the Met, Anstice was sealed off in a compartment on his own where gossip could not travel.
That's over. Ended months ago.
Really? Tough break,
said Anstice, looking genuinely sorry as the lift began to move downwards. But Strike thought that some of Anstice's disappointment was for himself. He had been one of the friends most taken with Charlotte, with her extraordinary beauty and her dirty laugh. Bring Charlotte over, had been Anstice's frequent refrain when the two men had found themselves free of hospitals in the army, back in the city that was their home. Strike felt an instinctive desire to shield Leonora from Anstice, but it was impossible. When the lift doors slid open, there she was, thin and mousy, with her limp hair in combs, her old coat wrapped around her, and an air of still wearing bedroom slippers, even though her feet were clad in scuffed black shoes. She was flanked by the two uniformed officers, one female, who had evidently broken the news of Quine's death and then brought her here. Strike deduced from the guarded glances they gave Anstice that Leonora had given them reason to wonder, that her reaction to the news that her husband was dead had struck them as unusual. Dry-faced and matter-of-fact, Leonora seemed relieved to see Strike.
There you are, she said. Why'd they keep you so long?
Anstice looked at her curiously, but Strike did not introduce them.
Shall we go over here? He asked her, indicating a bench along the wall.
As he limped off beside her, he felt the three police officers draw together behind them.
How are you? He asked her,
partly in the hope that she might exhibit some sign of distress to assuage the curiosity of those watching.
Dunno, she said, dropping onto the plastic seat.
I can't believe it. I never thought he'd go there, the silly sod. I suppose some burglar got in and done it. He should have gone to a hotel like always, shouldn't he?
They had not told her much then. He thought that she was more shocked than she appeared, more than she knew herself. The act of coming to him seemed the disorientated action of somebody who did not know what else to do except to turn to the person who was supposed to be helping her.
Would you like me to take you home? Strike asked her.
I expect they'll give me a lift back, she said,
with the same sense of untroubled entitlement she had brought to the statement that Elizabeth Tassel would pay Strike's bill.
I wanted to see you to check you was all right, and I hadn't got you into trouble, and I wanted to ask you if you'll keep working for me.
Keep working for you? Strike repeated.
For a split second, he wondered whether it was possible that she had not quite grasped what had happened, that she thought Quine was still out there somewhere to be found. Did her faint eccentricity of manner mask something more serious, some fundamental cognitive problem?
They think I know something about it, said Leonora.
I can tell.
Strike hesitated on the verge of saying,
I'm sure that's not true.
But it would have been a lie. He was only too aware that Leonora, wife of a feckless, unfaithful husband, who had chosen not to contact the police and to allow 10 days to elapse before making a show of looking for him, who had a key to the empty house where his body had been found, and who would undoubtedly be able to take him by surprise, would be the first and most important suspect. Nevertheless, he asked, "Why do you think that?"
"I can tell," she repeated. "Way they were talking to me, and they said they want to look in our house in his study."
It was routine, but he could see how she would feel this to be intrusive and ominous. "Does Orlando know what's happened?" he asked.
"I told her, but I don't think she realizes," said Leonora.
And for the first time he saw tears in her eyes.
"She says, like Mr. Poop."
He was our cat that was run over.
"But I don't know if she understands. Not really. You can't always tell with Orlando. I haven't told her someone killed him. Can't get my head around it."
There was a short pause in which Strike hoped, irrelevantly, that he was not giving off whiskey fumes.
"Will you keep working for me?" she asked him directly. "You're better than them. That's why I wanted you in the first place. Will you?"
"Yes," he said.
"'Cause I can tell they think I had something to do with it," she repeated, standing up. "Why they was talking to me."
She drew her coat more tightly around her.
"I'd better get back to Orlando. I'm glad you're all right."
She shuffled off to her escort again. The female police officer looked taken aback to be treated like a taxi driver, but after a glance at Anstis, acceded to Leonora's request for a lift home.
"The hell was that about?"
Anstis asked him, after the two women had passed out of earshot.
"She was worried you'd arrested me."
"Bit eccentric, isn't she?"
"Yeah, a bit."
"You didn't tell her anything, did you?" asked Anstis.
"No," said Strike, who resented the question. He knew better than to pass information about a crime scene to a suspect.
"You want to be careful, Bob," said Anstis awkwardly, as they passed through the revolving doors into the rainy night. "Not to get under anyone's feet. It's murder now, and you haven't got many friends around these parts, mate."
"Popularity's overrated. Listen, I'll get a cab."
"No," he said firmly, over Anstis's protestations.
"I need to smoke before I go anywhere."
"Thanks, Rich.
For everything."
They shook hands. Strike turned up his collar against the rain, and with a wave of farewell, limped off along the dark pavement. He was almost as glad to have shaken off Anstis as to take the first sweet pull on his cigarette.
Chapter 18. For this I find, where jealousy is fed, horns in the mind are worse than on the head. Ben Jonson, Every Man in His Humour.
Strike had completely forgotten that Robin had left the office in what he categorized as a sulk on Friday afternoon. He only knew that she was the one person he wanted to talk to about what had happened, and while he usually avoided telephoning her at weekends, the circumstances felt exceptional enough to justify a text. He sent it from the taxi he found after 15 minutes tramping wet, cold streets in the dark. Robin was curled up at home, in an armchair with Investigative Interviewing, Psychology in Practice, a book she had bought online. Matthew was on the sofa, speaking on the landline to his mother in Yorkshire, who was feeling unwell again. He rolled his eyes whenever Robin reminded herself to look up and smile sympathetically at his exasperation. When her mobile vibrated, Robin glanced at it irritably. She was trying to concentrate on Investigative Interviewing. "Found Quine murdered. See." She let out a mingled gasp and shriek that made Matthew start. The book slipped out of her lap and fell, disregarded, to the floor. Seizing the mobile, she ran with it to the bedroom. Matthew talked to his mother for 20 minutes more, then went and listened at the closed bedroom door. He could hear Robin asking questions,
and being given what seemed to be long, involved answers. Something about the timbre of her voice convinced him that it was Strike on the line. His square jaw tightened. When Robin finally emerged from the bedroom, shock